Welcome back to the Inside the Cross Pro Lacrosse Podcast. I am Kyle Devitt, the gear and lifestyle editor for Inside the Cross, and today I am joined by
Chris Rosenthal, Inside Lacrosse freelance contributor and pro lacrosse analyst.
Man, what week is it? 15? It was wild in pro lacrosse for both Major League Lacrosse and the Premier Lacrosse League. We are getting into the recaps from this past weekend's games. Chris and I switch every week. Last week I was PLL and he was MLL. This week I am doing the MLL recap. He is doing the PLL recap, and we are both going to come together for a preview of the PLL finals at the end. But first, Chris, the Chesapeake BayHawks hold off a very game Denver Outlaws squad 11-10. Just when you think we have enough data and enough patterns to analyze and predict a champion, this game happens. Also the next one. But here the BayHawks emerge victorious despite scoring 0 goals in the third quarter, and the Outlaws fall hard on their face after mounting a valiant comeback only to be felled by the Lyle Thompson Steele Stanwyck connection. 10 points combined from Lyle, who was, as usual, magnificent, and Steele here. The Outlaws' defense was scrambling to find different ways to cover them and failing to find the correct formula to even approach that feat. But really, how do you cover Lyle Thompson? You double him, he throws a pass that makes you look stupid. You single cover him, which the Outlaws did way too much of. Sorry, Eli Gobrecht. And he gets to go wherever he wants. You shut him off, and he still manages to affect and even dictate the play on the field because he understands the spacing better than anyone else out there. He moves his guy, the slider, out of range, opens up space, waits for the drive to a backdoor cut, and then goes and scores. Or he sets little baby screens and rolls off of them. Chris, he knows what his teammates are going to do before they do. Not before they do it. Before they even know what they're going to do. He's just so damn good, man. I don't know what else to say. This is where you need to fill this space, because I'm a little taken aback.
All right, let me carry the ball with this. Imagine knowing Lyle Thompson exists and having seen his work in the past and deciding to not watch him this summer. Couldn't be me. Could not be me. He has put together some of the most phenomenal stuff, and it's really just par for the course. None of this is new in the sense that it is a dramatic departure from the incredible things he's been doing, but it is largely new in the sense that he continues to find amazing, baffling things to do on this field. You could hear it during the game. It sounded like, and this is not a shot at them, it sounded like the broadcasters hadn't seen Lyle Thompson before, just because of the amazing things that he was doing. Like, that's entirely a testament to his productivity. Like, they were like, wow, you know, I and also bear in mind, this is a Denver broadcast booth. They were like, I kind of want to see them get the ball to Lyle again, because he's going to do something awesome, you just know it. And they were right, and he just constantly did. He produced time and time again. Another phenomenal game. Let me just throw this out here. I think, you know, we did our rankings earlier in the year, obviously, unfortunately, beset by an injury. I have to say Lyle is the best player on the planet at this precise moment.
I don't want to disagree with you, so I won't. And I don't think I can mount an argument that would be convincing enough for the audience to buy. I really don't. One of the other things we haven't talked about a lot this season is the Chesapeake defense, the down low pulls. I think part of that is a byproduct of how the BayHawks have played defense and how they've won their games. They've got all these offensive highlights, and it's so hard to take your eye off of Lyle and all these great players they have, Steele Stanwyck. They have all these offensive highlights. But their defensive highlights don't have, like, those defenders aren't throwing toe drags and, like, going BTB for goals. Like, if I say the BayHawks defense is, what springs to mind?
I would say silent assassins. They don't really have the kind of, and you know, we've seen it in the past with some of their guys. You know, this has been a year, I think somebody like, say, CJ Costabile has been productive when he's been in there, but we haven't seen so much of the flashy offense from him. You know, like you're saying about the, we haven't seen so much of the flashy offense, and we haven't seen so much of the flashy defense, but what we do see from guys like him, Jesse Bernhardt, especially, I've noticed this in the past couple of games, Warren Jeffrey, some of these guys, it's just kind of quick slides. As soon as they get there, they're throwing some serious checks on the gloves and, you know, just getting you to pass the ball, and then they slide back in. And it's just, it's very sort of, it's not the stuff that's going to show up on SportsCenter. You know, Bernhardt had like a little backhand goal, not this past weekend, but the weekend before. But generally speaking, they're kind of just staying in their lane, handling their defensive responsibilities, and then giving it to guys like Thompson and Heacock and guys like that, and they're taking care of it on their side. They're not really doing as much of the mixing as we've seen in the past with the Bayhawks polls.
Yeah, I think also it's a little bit indicative of bucking a trend, because I think defenders have become more than just guys that play defense, to the point where we now overlook how that contribution affects the game, which is the primary like purpose of a defender is to stop offensive players from getting to their preferred spots and scoring with their own positioning, checks, and off-ball decisions. Like, those three attributes are essential to determine the success of a team defensively. And I think Chesapeake has a crop of defenders that are dedicated to what I would now call that old school approach to that position. I mean, they still have guys like CJ Costabile, but like you said, but guys like Jesse Bernhardt, Warren Jeffrey, Greg Danseglio, they're really throwback style players. And I just want to acknowledge that. And, you know, we see you guys. I know we're not talking about you as much as you would like or even anyone else would like, but we see you and we understand, like, your contribution to this team and to the league. Faceoff man Kenny Massa did a great job here of tying up the Outlaws' Max Adler. Just kind of wrestled with him long enough for the Wings to fight for the loose ball. Adler really hasn't kept up his record-breaking pace the last few weeks. Chris, you want to read into this at all? Do you have any takes here?
So here's my theory, and, you know, without speaking with or evaluating Max Adler, I can't say this is entirely accurate, but I thought this might have been a good weekend for him to rest a little bit, or, you know, if they could bring on someone else to kind of split some time with him or something like that. You looking at the Denver Outlaws, once they've made the postseason, there's no home field advantage to fight for, right? So as much as you want, you know, games to count in the sense that, you know, you're staying in a rhythm, your team's getting practice reps and things like that, they already know they're playing the semis in Denver. And if they win, they're playing championship in Denver. Like, they've got that locked up. I felt like this might have been a good week, you know, bring somebody else in there or something like that. Because he's already taken, at this point, he's taken the second most faceoffs in the league. He's taken 439 of them. And he doesn't really have somebody else going in and spelling him for those. He's generally just the guy there doing this. So it doesn't really seem necessary to me to keep bringing him out for that sort of thing. You know, other teams, like when he was last playing the Lizards, they threw two guys out there, you know, giving him two different looks to go against. And also, you know, giving two guys who are a little bit more rested than this one guy. You can wear them down that way. So, you know, maybe they're just counting on, you know, these days off to keep him relaxed. Maybe they'll give him some time off in the next week or something like that. But, you know, that struck me as something that was a little bit concerning moving forward.
Yeah, other players that didn't play here, no Junior. He was on the field, but he was coaching, not dressed to play. And no Zach Currier again for Denver. Guys like Tim Barber, Kyle Maher, and Mike Hernandez dressed instead. And it has to be said that didn't exactly pay off for Denver in terms of production, but Ryan Lee had four goals, and it's not like the Outlaws looked terrible. But the best Outlaw on the field was the pride of Hobart, Chris Aslanian, who, in my opinion, is the rightful MLL Rookie of the Year. He finished with two goals and three assists here, led the team in points. I continue to be impressed with his play. Chris, is he the best rookie in the MLL in 2019?
So I will say I'm also very much impressed with his play. especially him working in tandem with Ryan Lee. That's kudos to the Outlaws front office for constantly pulling these guys who just work really, really well at what they do. That being said, if I were to pick who I thought was the best rookie, and I can do that on the MLL site right now, I think they're still voting on that. I am going with Rattlers goalie Sean Scannone. Maybe I just have a soft spot for rookie goalies this year, but this guy I feel like was a game changer in a sense that we just don't really see at the other positions right now. Kind of came in and locked that down, helped put the brakes on the whole downward spiral in Dallas, and you know, leads the league right now with a save percentage of 54.75%. So my vote is to him, but certainly no shade thrown in the direction of Chris Aslanian, who is fantastic.
Yeah, and I would have to eat my words from last week that the hardest position to play in the pros is goalie, and the hardest transition to make from college to pro is goalie. So I can't disagree with you, but I already stated my opinion, and I, as usual, cannot back down in any way, shape, or form. So despite the results of this game with the Bayhawks winning 11-10, I believe we're back to thinking that these are the two best teams in the league. I don't want to make excuses for Denver, but they left two of their most productive players on the bench, and they still almost won. And the Bayhawks did win thanks to the play of their outstanding attack unit that could have easily put up 15 to 20 goals if their finishing was a little crisper. If you believe in history, the Bayhawks and the Outlaws have 8 titles between them, and the Blaze and the Cannons have 1. I'm not someone that puts a ton of stock into team history and league history, especially after this year and such an upheaval that's happened, but those numbers, very tough to ignore. Chris, how much would you bet on either the Bayhawks or the Outlaws to win the 2019 MLL Championship?
I would bet a whole bunch. It feels like right now they are just the steadiest and most consistent. And when you get down to this sort of crunch time, you're kind of looking for teams that don't have so much baggage, you know. And you know, granted, these guys, you know, like you're talking about, if you believe in history, you know, granted, these guys primarily weren't responsible for those things, but it still feels like there is some sort of a legacy behind them, some of these guys. And they do also have, you know, reputations from other areas, like, you know, Lyle Thompson, he's got all the international play and things like that. These two teams, their rosters especially feel less likely to blink in this really high pressure situation. And, you know, I'm still not going to bet against John Grant Jr. if there's one game to decide things. And the guys around him have just been outstanding. I mean, Zach Currier has just been stockpiling championships of all shapes and sizes. So they definitely have the resume to put this sort of thing together. And the Bayhawks, you know, this game, I think if you were kind of skeptical, because they've been kind of, you know, bouncing around a little bit, but if you were skeptical before, I feel like this one, you know, even with the guys who are out for the Outlaws, they put enough on paper, I think, to put them in that top two as well.
Speaking of teams that blinked, I think the Atlanta Blaze blinked and then forgot to reopen their eyes because the Boston Cannons beat them 19-9. Chris, the Cannons came alive, as I have never seen them do before, and absolutely destroyed the Blaze, particularly in the second half. The thing is, if you look at the stats, pun not necessarily intended, but kind of, you see how even the game actually was by the numbers. But as we know, Chris, numbers do not make the game. They are just a part of how you can break a game down, and that's why you and I watch games and talk about them here and write about them on InsideTheCross.com. That being said, this game did start out super weird. There were so many turnovers in the first 3 minutes that I thought that no one was going to score ever. It was fast break, trail check, turnover. Fast break, trail check, turnover. Fast break, trail check, ball goes out of bounds. It went on for 5 straight minutes. Total slop fest right until Mazzone scored for the Blaze with 5 minutes gone. From there, the game took off as both teams battled for control of the tempo and transition play in the first 15 minutes. As I said before, though, the result would be decided in the second half as the Cannons outscored the Blaze 9-4, including a 6-goal, technically 5-goal because it was a 2-pointer, third quarter that saw Boston hold Atlanta to 0 goals. I repeat, 0 goals. For Boston, Zed Williams settled in down low to attack very well, and that really opened things up for Kyle Jackson, who doesn't need a ton of room to get his shot off, and it was just one of the pairings that the Cannons decided to go with all game long. They played so much great two-man give-go game. Cal Dirth got into the action here. Kyle Denhoff, both looking great with 2 goals each. Rylan Reese had his best offensive game as a pro here. 2 goals, 1 2-pointer and a helper, not to mention 5 ground balls and a caused turnover. Mark Cogerton got back on the score sheet again with a couple of G's. This was a really balanced effort from Boston all over the field, and I feel like they really out-hustled Atlanta right at that, like from 5 minutes in, and when Atlanta scored, they knew they had to do better, and they turned it up just a little bit, and Atlanta couldn't match them, and that's how they won. Also, this was Randy Stott's first actual bad game in the MLL this season. There is no way around that. James Fahey did an incredible job guarding him, and the rest of the Boston defense offered timely support if and when it was needed. Kind of a lesson that maybe they should, you know, the Outlaws should have learned guarding Lyle. Still, didn't happen. the game plan was clearly to stop Randy Stats and make the rest of the team beat them. And that plan worked because the rest of the team didn't. Let's not lay all the blame at the feet of Stats because he doesn't deserve it. The Atlanta Blaze simply, and we've talked about this, I feel like every time we've talked about them, and like, if you're hearing like a change in my voice, it's because my head is actually in my hands right now. Because I don't know how else to say this. The Atlanta Blaze can't get their act together tracking back. It's been their team weakness for almost the entire season. You should know that Boston loves to clear with poles near the half line. You should also know that if you sub when they're doing that, you're going to get smoked and have to stop a shot or slide early or do something. The thing about the Blaze defense, though, is that they have all these good individual on-ball defenders. But what Boston did is they spread them out, got them to kind of ball watch and get nervous and kind of not know who was sliding. And then once you do that, all you have to do is pass around and get the best matchup. They're so loose with their pursuit and attention off ball that the whole possessions were just exercises in inconsistency. One possession, a defender would have a great stand, push a guy out, and force a pass out, right? And then the ball would go right back to him, and the guy would get an assist. And that guy was usually Will Sands. But if I'm scouting this game for a playoff matchup, the thing I'm looking for is the seams. I want to see strengths and weaknesses in different situations early and late in games to see what I can use in a few weeks. Because no MLL team is the same as they were early in the season. Does any team feel anywhere close to what they felt like on day one? It's been so long, right?
It has been forever, yeah. It is a sort of marathon where you have to kind of keep evolving and just kind of constantly figuring out what you need to be this month or, you know, this next couple of weeks or whatever, just to kind of get by.
And that's the thing. This was an incredibly long, long summer for these teams and players. You have to look at which players are dialed in and which players are downshifting due to fatigue. Every single team has guys on both sides of that fence. And the team that's going to win is the team that has the best balance. Or really the team that has less guys fatiguing. But right now I have no idea who that team is and neither does anyone else. So in that way, this is a very exciting time for the MLL. But unfortunately, their moment will have to wait because we are gearing up for the PLL Championship next weekend in Philadelphia. Chris, tell me who's playing there. Tell me what the stakes are and tell me about how we got to this position.
Absolutely will do. Beforehand, though, I do want to say, echoing something you just said, I want to shout out to James Fahey. great performance in this one. Previous weekend, he had to take on the Thompson assignment and absolutely shined in that one as well. So great job by him. Probably, I don't know what stage the voting is in at this point, but definitely deserves some nods for some defensive accolades towards the end of the season.
Absolutely.
Now, let's head over to the PLL. Start with this first game here. Well, actually, you know what? Your call. What do you think? Do we go with the contenders for the championship, or do we go with the contenders for the first-round pick?
Well, let's set up the championship, because we're going to talk about these teams a lot more, or at least one of them a lot more, in the next section.
That sounds good. All right. So, going on championship, Redwoods LC 12, the Chaos 7. Redwoods keep on rolling, pick up the third straight win, and they punch that ticket to Philadelphia to take on those Whip Snakes who were chilling this past weekend. And they will take them on next weekend for a crown that may or may not actually exist. Have we received any sort of confirmation on that?
I have no eyes on a crown. Yeah, I've had no eyes on a crown.
I mean, it was, you know, the hunt for the crown, but I don't know. They're going to put that in quotes or something? I don't know. We'll figure it out next week. Anyway. So this game kind of started off a little sloppy from both teams. You know, maybe it was because of the stakes. Who knows? A lot of passes going out of bounds, a lot of drop things like that. You know, Redwoods were a little bit less sloppy. They jumped out to this 5-1 lead, at which point Garrett Eppel popped Connor Fields in the back. You know, on the slide, Fields turns around, Eppel finishes the check. It happens. Draws a couple penalties. There's a bit of scuffle goes on. You know, obviously Fields actually down for a while on this, and you know, his teammate Buchanan comes running in to kind of, you know, stand up for him. It's a whole thing. Eppel's kind of you know, waving to the crowd. It's again, it's a whole thing. But long story short, smoke clears. Eppel's got to go spend some time in the box. Chaos ends up going on a run, and they end up taking. Just a six, they bring it all the way back, and it's 6-6 into halftime. Now, at that point, personally, I thought that maybe this was the sort of turning moment, because the previous weekend, they'd only scored 7. So I was like, man, if they got 6 at halftime, and they've, you know, gone on this 5-1 run of their own, they might have kind of, you know, it's, I don't know how much you believe in this or not, but, you know, there's the notion of, you know, poking the bear, waking them up, making them, you know, play angry and things like that. You know, I don't know if that's true or not, but it's definitely something that's largely subscribed to when it comes to sports. So I was like, maybe that's what we're witnessing here. Second half, though, the Chaos just kind of gets destroyed by all sorts of turnovers, forced turnovers and unforced turnovers, while just kind of the more steady-handed Redwoods, guys like Joe Walters and Jules Hedenberg, kind of just put the game out of reach. So all in all, I think the secret to the Redwoods' success was smothering defense that kind of continued this whole Notre Dame tradition of just breaking Albany fans' hearts whenever possible. It is just a thing that I think they revel in doing. I think they have a heel side that they really enjoy embracing. Exhibit A, I think I would point to this, would be Eddie Glazner showing up at the Albany game wearing his Notre Dame jersey. I just applauded and smiled at that sort of thing. I like the heels in that sort of situation. So I think they embrace that as well. And also, of course, cannot forget about Tim Troutner, who reminded everyone why he should be the Rookie of the Year, even though a lot of people probably feel like he is not going to be the Rookie of the Year. But we have already spoken on this last week.
Yeah, those people are wrong.
Sure, yeah.
It's fine.
You know,
you can be wrong.
But yes, wrong nonetheless, Tim Troutner, Rookie of the Year. Late in the game, too, I don't know if it was kind of the Chaos last gasps, if it was the Redwoods kind of losing a little focus because, you know, they're like, hey, we're going to the championship, and you know, get a little shaky, get a little excited. But they had some real open looks they were giving up to the Chaos late in this. One-on-ones sort of just running down the lanes wide open, and Troutner just kept turning them all away. I don't know if it would have been enough, but it definitely would have been enough to make the Redwoods very, very nervous. So here's what I wrote down after the third quarter. This was my notes during the game. I said, here's the deal. Chaos can't execute. And when you can't execute, you're not going to win. You're not supposed to win, and you don't deserve to win. It was just fundamental stuff. You know, as much as we can talk about, you know, specific plays and, you know, how do they defend the two-man game and how are they handling, you know, alley dodges and this and that. It was really just a lot of fundamental, you know, throwing and catching kind of things that was just really, really sticking it to them. So I said this last week is a player comparison, but I'm going to kind of spread it out for the whole sort of team as a whole. Like, the Chaos to me were like a Lamborghini that had a major oil leak and nobody ever managed to do anything about it. It was just the team representative thing. 7 points this past weekend tied the season low that they set the previous weekend, and they end their season with 3 losses in a row. Now, Kyle, I'm going to throw some numbers at you here. During this 3-game span, the Chaos scored a combined 8 second-half points. They shot 1 for 18 from 2, and Fields put up 5 points and 11 turnovers. So my question for you, what happened to the Chaos? Do you have a theory?
I have 2 theories that overlap. First theory, they ran themselves out. It's just too much, too fast. They couldn't keep up with their own pace that they set earlier in the season, and they're kind of like, they kind of went Tyson, early Tyson, when he was just knocking people out in the first round, and then, wait a minute, Tyson got hit in the mouth, and now he's kind of struggling to come back, and I love to use him as an example, because I don't think he's a good person at all, and is terrible in many ways, but the fighting style compares. The other thing is, I think everyone figured out what the Chaos were going to do on every possession and waited for them to do that and let certain players take shots. And they didn't let other players get close to the net. And those players being, most importantly, Miles Thompson. So you saw here, Thompson was one of those guys that actually, like, he was kind of injured. He missed some games. He had an elbow injury at some point. And he never really looked to be himself. But I think he's one of the few guys on the team that they started leaning on. And then, unfortunately, they started leaning on other guys like Kevin Buchanan to really produce for them. You know, and Demer Klass to really produce for them. And Miles Jones to really produce for them. Because Connor Fields wasn't putting up the same numbers. The problem is, none of those other people had enough time all season to get into a groove where, like, they were even able to fulfill that need. And when you run everything through one player, if that player kind of dips or is affected defensively or isn't getting the same looks that he got and is getting doubled more and people are throwing different things at him, you have to change everything you're doing. And same thing goes for Ficarro. I think people figured Ficarro out quickly as well, because he not only just likes to take twos, he likes to get to the mid-range spot and throw a deke and throw a dodge, throw a face dodge, and then shoot, right? He's not a guy that likes to shoot through people unless he has space. You know, the same thing with Demer Klass. Like, there are guys that are really good players, but also not guys that carry and distribute. Do you know what I mean? I feel like they needed one guy other than Fields to step up and distribute the ball. And it didn't happen for whatever reason. And other teams, you know, part of that is giving defenses a lot of credit, right? But also, the thing is, like, a shot clock puts pressure on you. If you're not only playing against the defense, you're playing against the clock every time you have the ball. The clock can be an extra defender. And it can be an extra defender in two ways. One, the obvious way, which is, oh no, time's running out, I have to shoot. The other being, they're not going to be ready for me to take this shot because it's so early. And earlier in the season, the Chaos were taking full advantage of that second part of the shot clock. And then teams adjusted to that. And they were never the same since. Never, ever the same team since that adjustment by other teams. And so this is really me giving the other teams a lot of credit, but also, you know, the Chaos had a lot of injuries and they had a lot of bad beats to deal with, and guys got fatigued down the stretch, and it really affected their play. And that, I think it's, so long-winded answer to your question, I think it's a combination of a lot of factors, but mostly, you know, teams adjusting and not having another capable or equal ability ball handler. And that's it.
Yeah. I think, you know, in hindsight, obviously, it's going to be way easier in hindsight to look at this than kind of getting caught up in what is just a host of factors playing into why the Chaos were kind of this phenomenon that was kind of sweeping through the PLL, right? Like, they were superstars, you know what I mean? Like, they had the Bomb Squad, and you got them doing the shirts, and, you know, like, they were the talk of the league, you know, just putting together all these personalities, very dynamic, you know, they're very stylish people, this and that. In hindsight, it seems like this is almost the ending that seems like the most likely ending to that. Because usually those stories in sports don't end with the championship. You know what I mean? Like, you have the high-flying offenses who, you know, they'll revolutionize the game or whatever. They'll have the superstar players who are like rock stars. And then you have the team like the Spurs doing like the two-handed bounce passes that go to the championship. You know what I mean? It's just, it is a very sort of tortoise and hare sort of mentality that seems to kind of get through most of these sort of sporting situations where the guys who really seem to get the most attention, and I don't fault them for that. If you have a big personality, you got a big personality. You know, it doesn't really affect whether or not you're good at lacrosse.
Yeah, it doesn't mean you're good.
Right. It doesn't mean you're good, it doesn't mean you're bad. It's just something about you. So many of these guys that have these personalities, and of course, if you're a new league, you're going to want to cash in on that, you know? Like, hey, let's promote these guys, let's do this, let's do that, let's get them out there, spotlight on them. And it, for a while, it was really big. It was, you know, it was the scene. But that just doesn't seem to always stick around when it comes to sports. And I think this is just another example of the high-flying offense. Maybe they get a little tired, maybe people get a little figured out, and there isn't a plan B. You know, and it usually ends like this. And then you have a team like, you know, you got some guys like the Redwoods who just kind of, you know, tinker a little bit here and there, figure some things out, take their shots early in the year, take their blows, kind of hang around 500, keep kind of ticking off what's working and not working. And, you know, and here we are. And one team's moving on and one team is not.
Yeah. I mean, listen, all credit to the Redwoods, too, because they were dead and buried as well. And their problem was that their offense was trash. And they rediscovered their form. They made some moves. They pushed some guys into different positions. Matt Kavanaugh, remembered he's Matt Kavanaugh, who, by the way, was all over the place in this game. Like a demon on the ride. And Ryder Garzy came in, gave them the injection they needed. Jules Henningberg came in. Like, this was a team that was unafraid to make moves and stick with their philosophy. And now they're going to the championship. So I give them a lot of credit. I know we like kind of trashed on the Chaos there, but the Redwoods play better and deserve to win. End of story. I don't think you can watch that game and go, well, I feel like Chaos should still go to the championship. No. You can't watch the last 2 weeks and tell me that they deserve to play the Whipsnakes. I'll give the Redwoods that. Like, they deserve to play the Whipsnakes.
Yeah, absolutely. If you feel like the Chaos should be in the championship, that's just because you're a Chaos fan, you know, and you like the guys on the team, something like that. And that's fine, but it is not merit-based at all. So let's step back a little bit, take a look at this other matchup, and then we'll get back and talk a little bit more Redwood stuff in a moment. There was another game on the weekend. Archers taking on the Chrome. Archers end up winning this one 12-10. This was the battle for the right to pick first in next year's draft. And it was won by a Tom Schreiber and Jackson Placeless Archer team. Beat a Chrome team was missing John Galloway for some mysterious reason and starting Alex Reddy in goal. Dom Starja suspended Brett Queener for the first quarter of this one, kind of as the in-house punishment for his Jules Henningberg hit after the one-game suspension was levied the previous week. Oddly enough, in this one, Queen ends up taking a Ryan Ambler shot straight off the dome and has to get escorted off the field and exit the game early. So he was in for the second quarter and some of the third, and then he was gone again. Weird ending to a weird sort of roller coastery season for that guy. But obviously a very, very, very huge entertainer when he was in there. Things just took some strange turns. For the game itself, as you can probably guess by the score, very close. Five ties in it. Neither team ever led by more than two. But I think one of the main things coming off the Archers here was how they managed to make up for Tom Shriver's absence. And I think they did that in two ways. And first was moving other guys around. You know, like, they've had Joey Sankey playing kind of straight midfield. Took a little bit of a focus to have him do some inverting, which obviously makes sense for someone like him who is, you know, that's his position. And he's just kind of been contributing as a midfielder. But, you know, you take him and you put him at the invert, then, you know, you've got him going against a short stick or something like that. It's going to work out pretty well for you. And Will Manny, we've seen him a lot, you know, on the wings, catching and shooting, you know, is only Will Manny can do. But he can do a lot of other stuff, too. I think you mentioned that last week. And, Will Manny's kind of setting up closer to the arc, looking to distribute, doing a lot more carrying than we're used to. And, you know, second factor, you know, to kind of make up for Shriver's absence, simple as it sounds, I think some of these guys just kind of stepped up and showed a sense of offensive initiative. You know, somebody's got to do it. You know, why not me? I think it's kind of the attitude some of them had. You know, we saw Stephen Kelly a couple of occasions. He did actually win the faceoff, and I think he liked his matchup against Conor Farrell's defense. So, you know, he took him to X and drove on him. Or, you know, he wasn't scared to, you know, carry it a little bit more, stay on there. You know, I think they're in a situation where they have so much trust in Tom Shriver, as, you know, he has certainly earned, but I think this was kind of a moment for everybody else to kind of show, okay, well, I can do a couple more things, too, to kind of chip in and get this team over the hump. Ryan Ambler, we saw this last week when Shriver went down, really kind of stepped up his offensive production. He performed a similar role from the midfield, where he's very good at running by people. So that's a great place to start, right? So, you know, he's doing like east-west dodges and then looking to feed or else looking to take the shots. And, of course, on the power play, after the one when he unfortunately took Red Queener out, right after that, he was in the same spot, took the same shot, and this time it went in. So he was productive in, I don't want to say in a lot of aspects because they, you know, certainly weren't trying to take Red Queener out, but you know what I mean. As for the Chrome, Jordan Wolf, I thought, had an excellent game. Just kind of doing classic Jordan Wolf stuff. Just as much as we said before, just turning angles very quickly, you know, running up to the defender, going one direction very quickly. That's, you know, that's what he does on an elite level, and he did in this game very well. Justin Gutterding played very well as well. You know, he had some plays dealing from X, set up on the wing a couple of times. He was kind of one of those guys similar to Will Manny in the sense that you could move him all over the field in this sort of this particular game. Now, so I think it was tough for the Archers to handle both of those guys with Jackson Place being out, but they still managed to, you know, win the game, of course. Another play that Gutterding had that was kind of indicative of his all-around-the-place performance. One particular situation, loose ball skips through. He's kind of hanging around the arc, and he scoops a ground ball that two other people are fighting for. You know, Scott Ratliff's trying to get over there and get it. Can't get it. Gutterding scoops it up and fires a two-pointer. Brings them back into it. So now I think, I'm thinking about this during the game, maybe it is the, you know, high-resolution cameras they're using or something, but I feel like I'm noticing a lot of stick grabbing this summer. I don't know if you noticed this.
Man, let me tell you, if you can get away with it, I've noticed it on every field I've been on all summer. So, and I might have participated in a little bit of it myself. You know, you do it till you get caught, man. It's definitely part of a new trend. I'll put it that way. It's trickled down to all levels, I will say.
Let me tell you, my new resolution next time I'm on a field is I gotta play way dirtier than I do.
Honestly, you do.
It hasn't crossed my mind, but like I'm grabbing some jerseys, I'm grabbing sticks. I gotta do what I gotta do, and apparently I am late to this trend because there's a whole lot of that going on this summer.
You're late to the dark arts. It's fine.
Yeah,
we'll teach
you. Happy to be on the team now, though.
Yeah.
So yeah, Gardening does that. works out well for him. Ratliff looked a little displeased about his stick being confiscated, but you know, he's going on to Philly, so he'll be fine. So I mentioned Jackson Play still being out, and you know, they came out and said he's out for the whole season, or for the remainder of the season. So I do want to ask you this, because that's kind of been the extent of what we heard. You know, there's a little bit of an update. They actually asked Tom Schreiber during the broadcast. You know, they were like, "Yeah, what's going on?" And he's like, "You know, well, he's in good spirits. You know, he's a great, great player, and you know, it's a tough place." And I mean, honestly, I would not expect Tom Schreiber to feel comfortable disclosing, you know, a medical update about somebody. That kind of caught me off guard, so I have to imagine it caught him off guard. But that being said, I'm wondering what you think about this. Where do you fall on the topic of player injury disclosure? Because it's always been an area where pro lacrosse is like leaps and bounds behind the big pro leagues, except for like playoff hockey, where they're like, okay, lower body, he's a little dinged up when you get hit by a bus or whatever. Like, that's all they'll say. But like, it noticed that it sets the contrast a little bit more distinctly with football revving back up. And, you know, you tune into ESPN or whatever, and they will say, you know, which particular bone is broken in the guy's hand, or, you know, what the damage is for the rib cart, whatever, you know, very, very specifics. Nothing like that in lacrosse, though. It's just kind of, you know, you get like one thing and then you don't really hear anything else. Do you think there should be more transparency in pro lacrosse in this aspect, or you think the other sports have kind of just taken it too far and can really just, as far as we go, just tell us, you know, if these guys are playing or not, kind of leave the rest to them?
I mean, the only reason that I know of that public injury reports exist is for gambling.
Right.
Especially for NFL. I mean, they obviously exist because leagues have collective bargaining agreements and unions have that as part of their reason. Like, if a player's not playing, you know, they want the audience to know and the fan of that player why that player is not playing. And PLL, you know, they tried to do transactions for a while. Let me just open up their transactions page. Last update, 8/20. So by the time you hear this, basically a month ago, and that's Matt Kavanaugh being activated from the injured list, as well as Eddie Glasner. So, that happened on the 20th. I don't know what's happened since then. And I think that, you know, because PLL is basically a single entity, you know, they can kind of do whatever they want, and we can grouse about it and talk about it and be upset about it as much as we want. They don't care because their product isn't for us. You know, we're trying to cover the league to help them, but also, like, we want to get the truth for the audience, but sometimes the audience doesn't want the truth. And as a single entity, they can control what they put out. And by the way, there's nothing wrong with that. The MLL does the same thing. You know, other leagues do the same thing. There's not enough outside action, let's say, for it to be something that more than, you know, high level fans and also people that like stat people and people like us that cover it are going to ask for, because the gamblers are going to have the power. And, you know, once you get fantasy lacrosse going here, which I guarantee you the next partnership after the season ends that PLL announces is going to be some sort of gambling platform. Like, I guarantee that. And listen, fantasy football is gambling. Like, hate to break it to you. Like, it's fun gambling, and you lose usually way less money unless you're like LeBron playing in that weird league where you had to pay like $10,000 or whatever to be in it. But, you know, it's like the nice, it's all been smoothed out for us. And that's good if you're into that. I just don't think that the PLL thinks it's important enough to inform everyone about injuries. And there's also something to be said for players not wanting people to know if they're injured or not, because there's plenty of guys this summer that have been healthy scratches. Plenty. And a lot more guys than you think were healthy scratches and not hurt. So I think there's something to be said there. They're protecting the players as well and protecting the image of everything. That's their job and their right as a company that is a sports league. So a little bit of like truth telling there. I'm not trying to like throw shade, but like that's the truth of the matter, and that's how it is. And that's our job, is to tell you how it is, and that's how I see it. I don't know if you have a different opinion.
Yeah, no, I'm on board with that. I think you touched on essentially the heart of the matter, which is, you know, if we say, hey, we should get some more updates on this. I think the answer from respective league offices can be, what are you going to do about it? And the answer is nothing. We can't do anything about it.
This no, is don't, just don't tell them that.
did I play that card? Did I show my hand? Yeah, I mean, but here's the thing. And you did say this, and Paul Rabel mentioned that earlier on in the year. I think maybe somebody asked him on like a Q&A or something like that by getting like fantasy lacrosse thing going. And yeah, he tied it to the gambling thing and says you basically need, I believe, a full season of stats and information and things like that. You know, just kind of so people can see that your sport is legit, that it isn't like a Globetrotters sort of
right,
you know, situation. Not to say that Globetrotters are not legit. I'm just saying they traditionally win so often that it would make it difficult to gamble on it. I put a couple bucks on the Washington Generals. If the odds are right, I'm sure there's some degenerates out there who would do the same, but they just got to kind of have the whole portfolio of games first. But yes, gambling is coming in some or many forms. And I think when that happens, they are going to have to do a little bit more disclosure when things like this take place. It's just going to be part of the trade-off. But for now, that's what we get. Now, as far as the other team involved, Chrome wrap up a season that I have to say was a bit disappointing, and I think everyone involved would agree with that. Unable to right the ship even towards the end here and make it to Philly for the number one pick battle. So let me ask you this. If you're running things at Chrome HQ, where do you go from here? What's on your mind this offseason, and where are you looking in the collegiate draft?
Well, in other sports where seasons like this happens, what happens?
People are updating their resumes,
yeah.
I would say.
People are... like, and by people, it's usually the coach and then the players. I don't think these players are going anywhere, and I think the problem that they had towards the end was that they really, like, couldn't get the right flow of finger guys versus thumb guys, right?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of finger pointing going on in huddles, very animated, not a lot of guys being like, that's on me. And that's either a culture thing, which I don't even think we can call it that. There's not enough evidence to call it that. And also the culture from at least 11 of those guys is solid. And we know that from where they played last summer. And one of the most solid culture teams literally ever in professional lacrosse. So I don't know if there needs to be, you know, a change at the top, or if certain guys are going to be moved so other guys can step in. But there's plenty of guys that really, really, really disappointing seasons on that team, not only to our standards and fan standards, but their standards. You know, there's got to be a certain level of guys that are like, why didn't I play here? Why did he play? And those are the guys like you can't keep, you know? Like, you have to stick with the guys that you know are proven. And the problem with PLL is, like, a lot of people are being introduced to PLL and being like, this guy's not good. It's like, well, it's on Team USA. You've never seen him play before. Now, and, like, he's playing in a different style and way, and, like, he's adjusting. And they're like, nah, he's bad. And it's like, no, there's a body of work that all these players came from that tells you who is good and who should be good and who isn't good is just stats, right? Like, you and I have watched many of these players play for almost a decade, some of them, right? We know what their tendencies are, how good they are, what they're good at, what they're bad at. And I think that the Chrome players were put in a position where they had to do way more stuff that they're not good at, instead of building a team around like a concept that everyone can get into. It didn't seem like a fun team to play for unless you're hanging out with Connor Farrell.
Right.
Like, that dude seems cool. I want to hang with him. Like, let's have a conversation. I want to talk about the game where you killed Merrimack. Like, I want to sit down and, like, have a real conversation with that dude. You know, like, that's a thing where the culture is different, and there are a lot of veterans on that team, and the new guys coming in are, some of them are proven, some of them aren't, and then you have veterans that clearly didn't match and still played anyway. And that's, you have to find the mixture that works there. And with that selection of types of players, it clearly doesn't, it doesn't work in the PLO. It doesn't matter even if it worked somewhere else before. You know, you have to I don't want to say blow it up, because you can't. Like, what are you going to do? Trade, you know, Jordan Wolf and like Joel White and John Galloway for like two first round picks or something? Like, what are you going to do? Like, how do you blow a team up like that? Like, then you're tanking, and then this whole playoff bracket is so you don't tank. Like, how are you getting better players if the best players on your team have devalued themselves by not putting up 50, 60 points? I don't know. I don't have a good answer for you, but like, something has to be done, because there were games where they were a complete tire fire. It was bad. It was real bad. So something's got to change, but I honestly couldn't tell you where to start. I couldn't.
Yeah, it's going to be very interesting to see what they do, and really if they have the room to shake things up. You know, we haven't, we're all kind of going into this unexplored territory because we've never seen a PLL offseason. You know, even if they wanted to make all of these earth-shaking moves, can they even do them? Are they permitted to make all the moves they might want to make?
Why are there no GMs, Chris?
Yeah, I got no idea. Who's going to call these shots? Who's going to call the shots? Who's going to, like, it's just such a cramped space, too. You know, even if they want to make some big moves, can they actually do them? Do they have to give everybody away for, like, a quarter on the dollar? Are they stuck for the next year like this? There's a lot of questions that we just don't have answers to, because we have no precedent for any of this stuff.
Yeah, I feel like you could just like trade a bunch of guys that you think are the problem but are very talented and get draft picks, because other teams would take those guys and use them better.
Right.
That might be a way to do it, but, you know, that's none of my business.
Yeah, good luck to them. Flip it to the other team real quick. So Archers move on, head to Philly. Barring trades, either the Archers or Atlas will pick first in next year's draft. If you are running things at Archers HQ, whatever that is, we'll say, who do you take if Spencer is on his way? So let's start with that. Pat Spencer is coming. He has signed something, and he will be there. Then who are you looking at? Or what position? Either one.
You're taking T.D. Ireland no matter what anyway. I don't think it matters, honestly. I don't think it matters. I think you take T.D., and then you pick up some defensive help later in the draft. And that's it. This is the end of it. Like, I really think it's that easy. Just like taking Pat Spencer with the first pick is easy. So, I don't know, man. I think that's the easy one. I think the harder question is, do the Atlas pull a trigger on a true X playmaker? You should. And do they take, like, Sowers or Amen? Or do they go with what you and I kind of agreed on, which is Doc Sakin, to kind of build that midfield even stronger? Or do you mess with everyone and take T.D. Ireland and run the two-headed monster that won't lose a faceoff? I don't know. Atlas is more intriguing than Archers to me. I think Archers is a foregone conclusion they would take T.D. to me.
Yeah, Atlas is so... So it's going to be very exciting next weekend. If Atlas wins this game, then just a whole bunch of drama is going to begin. I mean, drama that we enjoy. It's going to get messy.
Yeah.
Atlas is going to be messy. The only thing that I think they could do that wouldn't be, like, you know, just tremendously messy is if they kind of went defense. You know, that's like a super tame sort of thing. But other than that, like, if they go attack, they're going to have to move some guys. Or, you know, midfield, there's going to be some sort of distinctions made at least. And personally, I am here for it. There's going to be something very exciting if the Atlas get the pick. Archers, I agree with you. I think it's going to be almost just kind of like walk up to the board and make your pick and then sit back down. Everybody will be like, okay.
Or make it like months before the draft and just be like, we'd like to announce that we're taking TD Ehlin.
Right. And nobody will bat an eye. They'll be like, yeah, of course you are.
Also, P.S., how do you like me now? That is a weird thing to put on this draft card, but thank you, sir. Good job.
Yeah, so, you know, if you are rooting for, I was going to say chaos, but I guess uncertainty. If you're rooting for uncertainty, if you're rooting for things to get messy, then you are an Atlas fan this upcoming weekend. And if you're rooting for the Archers, then you're an Archer fan. I think that's pretty much what it comes down to.
Yeah, I root for stuff to get weird at every possible turn. So let's just vote for the weirdest outcome and hope that it provides as much entertainment as I think it can.
Absolutely. Some men just like to watch the world burn.
Yep.
Now, took care of both of those games, so let's talk a little championship, shall we?
Little championship preview. I like it.
We got the Redwoods. We got the Whipsnakes. These guys have met twice, of course. Last time they met, week 9 in Hamilton, and in case you forgot, Redwoods got absolutely steamrolled 17-4. However, that is the game that Eddie Glazner missed, and John Sexton had to get bumped down to close defense. Everything takes, you know, a different shift from there. You got to bring somebody in the long place in the long stick and bring Larkin Kemp in for that. Everything gets rearranged. Also, Matt Cavanaugh was out with an injury, so that's a big deal as well. So let's start with this question. Week 9 meeting in Hamilton. Do we throw that out completely, or is there anything we look to take away from that?
I think what you take away from it is from the other side, right? Like, how well and game planned were the Whipsnakes in that trouncing? Because that was the game that was 10-1, right?
Yeah, it was very bad.
So that was a complete massacre, the likes of which we have not seen since. And I think that you... What happens when that happens later on, those two teams meet, is the team that did well is actually going to keep doing well. Like, they're not going to be overconfident because they're going to know what they're capable of, right? And I think we talked about this before. If the Whipsnakes have a true weakness, it's because it's their youth, right? It's their kind of lack of experience, not everywhere, but in certain positions at the pro level, isn't there because they're younger guys, right? Not a ton of pro championships rolling around on the Whipsnakes, but I don't think it matters when you're that talented. That being said, I also don't think that the Whipsnakes game plan as much, or not as much, as specifically as the Redwoods do. I think if any team like over game plans, it's the Redwoods. And also, one of the things they learned in that Whipsnakes game is some of the stuff they just flat out can't do. And some of the stuff they flat out can't do is just replace like for like. They don't have that capability. But they have all their players healthy. They're playing at the highest level that they've played at all season going into the championship game, setting up what could be an epic showdown. But I'm going to say what I said last week. That if you want to beat the Whipsnakes and get that first crown, you have to have your best day. Period. And the Whipsnakes just can't play bad. So who's the pressure on, really? You know, I feel like it's a lot more of that pressure is on the Redwoods to prove that that game was not only a fluke, but also to prove that, you know, they belong in the championship game, which they have the last 2 weeks. But if you've been watching them all season, you're like, what am I watching half the time? Because they've been so mercurial and up and down with their execution, late in games, early in games, all sorts of stages. And what you have to think about is, did they learn from that and now they're ready? Or are they going to go back to that and lose?
Right, yeah. Even if some things were off and they had to do some rearranging, kind of piecing things together, there is that sort of looming shadow over them that they did get their teeth kicked in the last time.
Yeah.
You know, there are obviously explanations and this and that that you can tell people, but people saw it. You know, it is on film. We saw, you know, the dejected looks. We saw this. We saw that. As much as we want to discount or put asterisks or anything by it, there is that sort of ugliness the last time they were on the field with these guys. And, you know, ideally, if you are a Redwoods or Redwoods fan or whatnot, you're going to use that as some sort of fuel. And Whipsnakes can, you know, kind of play it conversely and say, you know, look, we can take care of these guys we did last time, but we have to be careful. We know it's not going to be as easy. We have to be prepared. And we've seen these guys revving up this momentum over the past couple of weeks. The first matchup is back in Atlanta in week 5. Whipsnakes took this one. Actually, sorry, Redwoods took that one. Sorry, flipped that around. Yeah, they split the series 14-11 in that one. But a couple of things, you know, so early in the year, a couple of things still were being shaken out differently. You had Ben Reeves playing attack, of course, instead of the midfield we've seen him running in lately. Also on that attack for the Redwoods, you have Clark Peterson down there, who was starting with Jules Hendenberg and Matt Kavanaugh. You hadn't really seen the sort of, like, you know, Ryder Garnsey was there, he scored a goal, but it's kind of a quick sort of transition, he's sprinting to the goal kind of sort of thing, not so much him doing the ball carrying or initiating or anything like that. And we haven't really seen him, by week 5, he hasn't really revved into this sort of post-All-Star game form where he's just been, you know, leading the league and scoring sort of thing. And also part of that's coming from the fact that he's still sharing time to just to get on the field. But, you know, the Whipsnakes defense has to play things a little bit differently when you have Garnsey out and Peterson in. So in this game, they're like double pulling on Joel Walters and Sergio Salcedo and sticking a short stick down there on Crease attack. So with all that sort of stuff in mind and the fact that it was week 5, is it a similar sort of situation from the first game, even though the score is much closer? Do you have to discount some of that as well?
I think because it's so early, it's easy to say yes, but the other thing you have to look at, you know, that's also the game where Matt Rambo had 8 points and Matt Kavanaugh had 6, and neither defense could solve X for either one of those guys. It's also one of the games where, you know, the Redwoods midfield showed up, and they've been showing up the last couple weeks, but it's hard to forget kind of their long stretches of absence most of the season. I think, you know, obviously, you know, you had Chan and Chuck playing in this game as well. And I think one of the things that the Redwoods struggle with is how to defend twos. Not that they've like let a ton in, but they're not really good at advancing out, right? That Triforce defense, that Notre Dame defense, they're so good at kind of helping each other on the corners and holding down the crease and stopping guys at GLE. What they're not good at is rotating up and stopping outside shots. And if the Whipsnakes can kind of take advantage of that and run the ball top to bottom instead of running everything through Rambo, even though clearly no one can defend Rambo either. And if Rambo's at top health, I think that's going to stay true no matter what. If the Whips can run the ball through guys like Drew Snyder, Channon Chuck, Joe LoCascio, they're going to get good looks and good shots, and then it's going to be up to Trouter. And I think that the key here for the Whips is mid-range stuff and not pressing that attack, or sorry, that Redwoods defense as much, but choosing the moments to attack with their own guys on attack. You know, and I think Rambo is definitely the key there, and I think everyone would say that, but I think you have to look at what they do with Rambo. And they've kind of not lessened his role, but he's had definitely less points the last, you know, month or so of the season than he had, you know, for example, here where he exploded for 8. And I think that's probably because, not because of matchup, but because the help is coming faster for him. Because teams know he's rolling to the inside. And I don't think there's going to be as many opportunities for him to roll to the inside to score, but there's going to be tons of opportunities for him to feed mid-range and top of the two-point line kind of cutters and little pick sets. And the Whips are really good at setting picks off ball. So the Redwoods shorties have to really stay vigilant, stay with their guys, and communicate a lot, or the possibility remains for them to get torn up.
Yeah, and speaking of Rambo, I would say if we're looking at this game from, you know, what do you put on the marquee for the main events, of course, certainly think he's earned it at this point. I would put him in the potential matchup with Rambo versus Apple, which, based on the previous matchups, is what we're likely to see this time. You know, they might want to switch some things up. If they get crazy, move Landis onto Rambo after, you know, Landis' success last week against Connor Fields. But I don't know if that's necessarily a move they're going to make this late in the game, you know, rolling something different out just, you know, for championship weekend. So as far as marquee main events, I'm going, you know, Rambo and Apple. But more as a whole, just Whipsnake's attack versus the Redwoods defense. Rambo, personally, like you mentioned, the 8 in the first game, he's got 15 points combined in the two. So I think the big question is if they're going to try to change some things, like I just mentioned, as far as, you know, if it's Apple and Landis, or if it's just kind of, you know, more quick slides or things of that nature, or if they're going to kind of go with the old Kobe strategy of, you know, let him get his, or don't worry so much about him getting his, and then really focusing on clamping down on everybody around him. Do you think, is there another kind of marquee main event? You go unit versus unit or player versus player that you're kind of looking forward to in this one?
It's Nardella Garendian. Like, times 20. Because those dudes, while they respect each other, not best friends. Not best friends. And I think Nardella is kind of the heir apparent at this point. And Garendian still is trying to prove, you know, which he has done at times this season, that he's still the best. And that conflict is going to be so interesting to watch, because you know that Nardella is going to do more ball carrying and try to keep Greg on the field as long as he can. And that's going to, depending on who's winning the draws, going to give one team an advantage over the other. And it looks like the Whips, if they go 50-50, Nardella's going to stay on the field a lot more. And he's going to get some points. And I think if Greg can push the ball forward and get good shots and the Whips don't slide to him, he's going to get some points too. So I want them both to, like, win half and then battle for points. Like, that's kind of how I want that matchup to play. I don't know if that's how it's going to play out, but I see in the future, Chris, I see in the future a 1 minute long face-off happening in this game. Are you ready for that?
I am looking forward to it, because I do not mind the one-minute face-off. I am also anticipating a wave of complaining online about face-offs taking too long, and somehow another wave of people complaining about people complaining about face-offs. But I actually enjoyed the face-offs themselves. So all of that is very, very likely to happen this weekend.
Absolutely.
So let me ask you this. What do you think? We'll go with the Whipsnakes here. Fill in the blank. Whipsnakes win if...
Whipsnakes win if they play their game. And I know that sounds simplistic. It sounds easy. But they're so talented at so many positions. And they have so much, like, wiggle room to get even better, that I think watching them sometimes is scary. Like, when they are dialed in, when they are running on all cylinders, I don't know if I've seen that many teams that are as good as them. Like, man for man, all the way across the board, starting from Burnlore all the way up to Rambo. They have all world, all pro guys at every single position. And more importantly, every single role that that person plays, they are one of the best in the world at that role. Bryce Young is the greatest second defenseman on the planet. Michael Earhart is probably the best LSM on the planet. Rambo is like some mixture of, again, cowboy walking in off the streets, gunslinger, and dude that defies all laws of the game, and ability to read the game that is so much, like, belied by his persona. Like, Rambo's ability to tear down a defense and tear down a defender is actually pretty complicated when you look at how he sets up his steps and his dodges and his footwork. It's honestly, technically beautiful. And that's just one guy at attack. And then you have Ben Reeves playing wherever he wants. And people forget, Ben Reeves, one of the best players in NCAA the last 10 years. One of the best, if not the best. Like, there are guys all over the field that are so good that I honestly think if they can stay in a positive headspace and play their game, they will win. Not they can win, they will win. And the Redwoods are going to have to do something to get them out of that comfort zone to even have a chance to win.
I definitely agree with that. And I agree with all that sort of thing. And Rambo, the thing about him is, like you said, it's very sort of complicated, complex sort of displays he kind of brings out there when he's running the attack. But he makes it all look very easy. The level, the disparity between the stuff he's doing and the ease at which he does it is a very startling contrast.
Yeah.
I'm going to say Whipsnakes win, or they have a much better chance of winning if they can hit the ground running in this one. They had the week off. For better or worse, you know, we don't really know what that's going to mean. Is it really better for them to have this week off? They got to watch the other team, and granted, if they had any sort of, you know, scrapes and bruises or something like that, maybe they could rest up a little bit. But if there's any sort of, you know, if there's any sort of tightening in the emotional sense, you know, they've had this silence, you know, and when you're just kind of, the silence does two different things. You know, you can be in that space and it can relax and get you ready to go, or it can kind of mess with your head a little bit. You know, like, some people don't like the time off. Some people don't like, you know, feeling relaxed in this sort of situations. And if you're the Redwoods, you are, you know, rolling up to the starting gate. You know, you have just been going this whole time, and you've got this momentum going behind you. And the Whipsnakes, they had, I mean, their game against the Chaos, their offensive production in that is up there with some of the, you know, some of the most dominant performances they have had all season. You know, like, a lot of these games these guys are playing, they're like, you know, 12-11 games, you know, 12-10, things like that. You know, putting out 15 goals, and they had an 8-goal quarter, like, that's huge, but then it stopped, and we don't know if it's going to rev back up immediately.
Right.
And I feel like if it's going to take them a quarter or two and get things going, and they're facing a team that's just been, you know, steamrolling and freight training this whole way for the past couple of weeks, it might be easy for them to kind of get popped in the mouth early and then kind of have to adjust and kind of wake up. If they can go into it right away with, you know, all systems go, I think they'll be in much better shape than if they're going to have to, you know, take a shot or two and then kind of get back into it and respond.
Yeah, I would agree with that. That's, I mean, there's so many things that could happen that early that would affect this game. I feel like this game can be decided in the first 10 minutes. I feel like it's that kind of a game. It's that kind of a championship that we're looking at here. I really do.
Yeah, definitely. And PLL games are just so quick.
Yeah.
It can be, you know, somebody can hit a two, and then the next thing you know, if you're down on yourself for a second in these games, you know, or you're like, you know, you drop your stick and somebody scores or something like that, if you can't shake it off immediately, then, you know, it's the third quarter all of a sudden, and you're looking up wondering what happened. Flipping it to the Redwoods, how do you think the Redwoods can win this one?
I think they need to play their best game. And I don't say that as a disparaging comment at all or any disrespect. I think that they probably know that. You know, that midfield has to put up 8 goals. And that attack has to keep producing at their rate as well. I think if this game, you know, if they can keep it under 20 goals combined, the Redwoods have won. Right? If this is a 10-9 game, I feel like the Redwoods have 10 and the Whipsnakes have 9. And something went really wrong for the Whipsnakes, and something went really right for the Redwoods, and the Redwoods kind of played their way. And that's not to say that the Redwoods are bad at transition or, you know, ramping up a score or grabbing the momentum. They're actually very good at it. But I think what you touched on earlier is like that inconsistency of sometimes they have a tendency to let up on the neck. They don't always step on the neck. And also the Whipsnakes in their last game, they didn't step on the neck either, but that game didn't count. So, you know, the playoff game with the Archers I'm talking about. Regular season finale with the Archers. I think that one of the things you look at is how, again, I said mentally prepared, but also how banged up are these teams? How hurt are they? How did that week off really help the Whips like recover a little bit more and they're going to be even better? Or did they get, you know, even more banged up in the off season or in the off week? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question, but I think that if it's anything close to they're not rolling up, like you said, to the gate ready to play, the Redwoods have a distinct possibility to rattle off 5 straight goals to start the game. And then the Whips are in trouble because then we know that the Redwoods can put the clamps on and kind of limit a lot of things that a lot of teams can do in the league offensively, including the Whipsnakes. But I do think that that Whipsnakes team is strong enough, especially in the midfield, to come back against that. And then it becomes kind of a seesaw game. And then that's how the Redwoods win, is if it's a seesaw game. You know, I if it's goal for goal and they're matching, I think that kind of helps the Redwoods because they have a more complete scoring and diverse scoring attack. But if it's more back and forth and kind of top-down play or face-off start kind of factoring in a little bit more for the Whipsnakes, I think the Whips just take it away. So the Redwoods really have to play even, consistent defense and have smart possessions. And that's really the key for me. If you don't have smart possessions in the PLL, you lose. You have to have more smart possessions than dumb possessions. Sometimes dumb possessions get you goals, but not often. And the teams that, and that's why I am so adamant about the Whipsnakes being able to win this at a not lesser effort, but more likely to win because they value their possessions more and they have so many, players that are bailout guys.
Yeah.
Like there's 10 seconds left in the clock. Two pass to Chaney up top. And one guy runs off and they sub. That's one of the things they do so well, where like Chinatuck takes a shot and like he always he aims a little higher at the end of the clock. So the goalie can't kind of like grab it. And if he can, he goes off stick so that the ball goes out of bounds. So then they have time to sub. He doesn't often put it for an easy save. And shooting percentage aside, I think that's something to really look at is two-pointers, how that factors in and how these teams are going to combat each other's strengths. And the Redwoods have to stop the Whipsnakes late in the clock to win.
Absolutely. I'd say you mentioned midfield a little bit. I would say their big sort of big flag they're going to have to plant here if they win the game is they're going to have to find a way to keep the Whipsnakes midfield at least somewhat quiet, because there's just so many options, so many diverse scoring options out of this midfield. Just being good at stopping like a dodging midfielder isn't enough. You're going to have to be good at stopping somebody like Chanichuk, who's just a seriously huge concern in this sort of situation. But then you also have, you mentioned Reeves, and if this guy's driving, are you going to put a pole on him? And then you're going to really, really tax the short sticks if they're going to have to keep up with guys like, Drew Schneider or Lacasio. They have so many weapons out of that midfield that everyone's going to have to be accounted for, and they all beat you in different ways. You don't have the luxury of facing off against identical midfielders in that sort of group. Everybody's got their own sort of styles and moves that they can use to beat you. It's much easier if you have a team with like, okay, here's, two alley dodgers and a 2-point threat, and that's that. You can just kind of figure it out. You don't have to worry about if you get kind of bumped off your assignment with some pick play. You don't have to worry about your matchups not working out anymore. But in these sort of situations, those guys are so unique that it is a very, very difficult situation. And if they can keep them at least somewhat quiet, I think they have a much better chance of pulling this off. So now we did another thing when we were looking at this previous matchups last week. So I wanted to kind of carry it over to this. Who's somebody you're looking forward to watching in this game? We'll start with the Whiff Snakes. Other than Rambo or Earhart, I like to try to throw out the kind of first ones that come to mind. You know, Rambo we talked about, Earhart we talked about this week, and, you know, in previous ones. I'll just say Joe Nardella. You mentioned him a little bit earlier in the Nardella-Granlian matchup. The last time they played the Redwoods was kind of one of those big games for him. He's had some moments also, like the Atlas, a couple other matchups, where he really shows off not even just the face-off ability, but the ability to run as a midfielder or to, you know, start a situation as soon as he gets the ball. You know, he's going to – if he's handing out assists, if he's pulling up for easy goals, especially if you're making substitution errors, which kind of bit the Redwoods last time. You know, they got caught on that, and they really took advantage of, you know, trying to sub. You know, I think at this point we should all know – you can't just assume, now the face-off's done, time to get off and sub. He will make you pay, and he is definitely going to be under the microscope in this game. And, you know, just conversely, that same sort of thing applies to Greg Aurelien. He's going to have to be a defensive midfielder for much longer stretches than he's traditionally used to. I think, you know, Nardella, you know, we saw the sort of thing with Stephen Kelly in the Archers game, where he, you know, he wasn't afraid to stay on and go work from X or something like that. I'm not saying Nardella will necessarily set up an X per se, but I do think there's a chance he won't be afraid of running a little bit or trying to take advantage of the matchup. So it's a big game for Granlian, and definitely a big game for Nardella. Who's a whip snake? Who kind of somebody you're looking forward to watching this one?
I'm gonna go with Ryan Drenner. I think that kind of, you know, again, an embarrassment of riches in the Whip Snakes offense. I think he's a guy that, you know, he had that, maybe he had his quote unquote moment, right? He had his 15 minutes early in the season. He had those back-to-back game winners, had some huge points, did really well in the All-Star game. And then like kind of not leveled off, but didn't explode for like 10 points or whatever, or 8 points anytime after that. But we know he can, we know he's clutch. And we know that he plays really well off of Rambo. And that is key. I was going to say Connor Kelly, but I feel like Kelly's been kind of like in and out of the lineup. And I think that there are other midfielders there like Drew Snyder that I would look at. But Ryan Drenner, how are they going to use Ryan Drenner? He's the kind of the utility guy, right? Like they can use him anywhere. He can clean up stuff on the crease. He can dodge from the low wing. He can run out of the box if they want. He's just so multifaceted. So he's the guy I really want to see in this game and see what they do with him, because that's the exciting thing about Ryan Drenner is like, how are they going to use him? Because he's so skilled at all these different aspects. And how is Stags going to use him in this matchup? I don't know. I'm looking forward to it. I want to see what they're going to do.
Man, how did I not think to say Ryan Drenner? I feel like such a jerk. I'm glad you gave him some press on that.
You're not driving the bus anymore.
I'm not, you know what? I got too comfortable on the bus. I got out and started ghost riding the whip. I was celebrating, having a good time, and started veering off course.
No.
But I appreciate you bringing it back.
Too early.
Yeah, too early for that. Flip it for the Redwoods here. Other than let's get rid of Eppel, because he's had a big couple of weeks under the spotlight, and Matt Kavanaugh, because he is – you know, historically Captain Clutch, and we have seen him shining in postseason play in the past. Who is a member of the Redwoods that you are looking forward to seeing in this one?
I'm going to go with my dude, P. Harb. I want to see – there is a great highlight from this past weekend's game where Pat Harbison looks dead to rights, absolutely surrounded midway up to the half line, and he beats a triple. And it's like this little moment – but I didn't go, oh no, he's got three guys on him. I went, oh, he's halfway there. He'll get out of it. And I don't know any other player I think that about in that situation other than him. And that's the kind of play that can win you a championship. And like, listen, we've written articles about him. We've talked about him a lot. He's gotten a lot of, you know, press on the PLL kind of YouTube and all that stuff. And he's got a great personality, but like, I've been watching him play for a while, and this is probably one of the first times I've seen him 100% healthy at this point of a season. So I'm kind of excited to see what he can do in that scenario and see like what kind of damage he can cause up and down the field and kind of being that second guy coming out of the scrum with the GB, leading to a fast break, getting the hockey assist, not getting in the stat book, but really winning over his teammates.
Absolutely. He is one of those guys who makes everybody else's job way easier. And, you know, and you can really go a long way when you have somebody like that on the roster. I'm going to say Sergio Perkovic. And the reason why I'm saying Sergio Perkovic is because over the past few weeks, he has kind of undergone this transition in like what his role and responsibility appear to be. And, you know, along with that, he just kind of has to change who he's been as a lacrosse player. You know, he shows up from Notre Dame and he is, you know, north, south, shoot so hard you fall over, the end, right? That's his style. That's his move. That's what we know Sergio Perkovic for doing. I think this season, you know, I don't know if it ever came down to this, but, you know, you got to justify your existence, justify your playing time. If the shots aren't falling, you gotta give them a reason to keep you out there. What can we do to make sure you are giving us something, you know? And so what they've been doing is they've been running him on the field like all the time. He's playing like defensively, and then he's kind of running in transition. And, you know, obviously there's a lot of responsibility that goes into that for a team sort of stance, you know, as far as helping out your teammates. But there's also a personal responsibility as far as kind of maintaining your, you know, maintaining your stamina, your tank. You know, you got to be prepared to contribute offensively, but you also have to do all sorts of things on the defensive end as well. So this is obviously, like I mentioned, you know, kind of how many midfielders you have to be worried about from this Whipsnake team. So this is kind of the culmination of the Sergio Perkovic story, you know, and he's made this transition into this sort of different role that he's got to do now. Well, this is the ultimate test for him, because if they're going to wheel him out there in the same way in this game that they did in the previous games, you know, is he going to be matched up against Drew Snyder? You know, is he going to be matched up? Is he going to be in some sort of weird situation where it's just like him and Bernhardt going back and forth over and over again or something like that? He's going to be tested in, at least I expect him to be tested in ways that he has not yet been tested in this new sort of refined two-way Sergio role. So either he's going to shine or they're going to have to adjust to some issues. But this is going to be, I think, a big game for him one way or another.
Let me ask you a question about Sergio Perkovic.
Mm-hmm.
How many points does he have? Guess. Just guess.
I would guess 10 games he has scored
12. 10 goals. 12.
Okay.
12 games. How many points does he have?
Oh, yeah, right. Postseason as well. I don't know. I will guess 58 points.
That is close. He has 14.
Oh, wow, okay.
But how many two-pointers does he have?
I don't know.
One.
One, okay.
He has one. I think the Redwoods did the right thing, moving him out there to play different positions. I think he's a player that needs to be involved in the game to put up stats in a game, if that makes any sense. And
yeah,
he can't be like the third guy out of the box. He's got to already be there. You know what I mean? And the Redwoods also have other guys like Joe Walters, who does need to be the first guy out. So they can't put him in that position. So he kind of had to feel his way around this year. And I think that, to his credit, Sergio Perkovic remembered at some point in the last couple games that he is 6'4", 230. He just remembered and was like, oh, right, I can smash you. Who are you? I'm a beast. I'm going to eat you. And that's what he's done. So I think you're totally right in picking him. I'm not picking on him or you for picking him, but I think that this Sergio Perkovic is the best form of Sergio Perkovic, the give no care Sergio Perkovic, for lack of a better term, coming to mind, kind of slipping out there. But I feel like that's the best place for him to be mentally and physically on the field. And then they're pairing him kind of with Brent Adams and then alternating them, which I think is really smart. And you've seen production kind of uptick for both of them. So I think that's kind of a good approach for them. And also, it's definitely something to watch if you're the Whips. Because I don't know if you really want to have Drew Snyder straight up dodging on Perkovic. Because if he does a wrong move, like, Perkovic will just flatten his face and put him down. I don't think that'll happen, but it's a possibility. And I think it could be really interesting, and that's a really great pick to watch in this game, especially considering his different role. And again, I'm kind of drawing on, he played 10 games and had 10 points and had 9 goals before these last two games in the postseason, where he had a two goals and an assist. So you got to look at something like that, moving his team forward by playing a different role that he's better suited to, that maybe he didn't think he was. But that's also the genius of Nat St. Laurent, because he convinces these players that they're good at different things, and he's got a really good connection with them. And I think that's something to watch. It was on full display with the Jackson Place kind of incident collision, but also, like, he's been very compassionate and also forceful all season. And, you know, again, that's not saying he's better than Staggs. Staggs literally wakes up in the morning and eats gravel and broken glass. But I think that Nat St. Laurent will have a game plan for the Whips that maybe he's learned a lot of things in this first kind of pro season as a head coach that I don't want to underestimate them. And I still believe in the Whips, but Redwoods, man, they've got a lot of wild cards. There's a lot of wild cards in that deck. So this is going to be a really exciting championship game.
Looking forward to it.
All right, let's skip the big question because we basically just did it, and we'll go on to the recommendation of the week. Chris, you have a sad one, so you go first.
So, yeah, it is kind of sad, I suppose. The reason behind it, Rick Ocasek, lead singer and mastermind behind the Cars, unfortunately passed away on Sunday, I believe. And so, of course, what usually comes with that for most radio stations and everything like that is a lot of retrospectives and a lot of, you know, let's get out there and play the greatest hits. And so I think the Cars are definitely one of those bands that you end up hearing a few songs and then you're like, yeah, I know that one as well. Like, even if you're not like a fan where you went out and bought Cars albums, you know, you'll just start hearing a bunch of songs, and then you, when you get them all in one place, that's when you're like, wait, that was all one group? You know, they have a whole bunch of bangers on that roster. And so my recommendation is go out and listen to some of the Cars. One of the reasons why I kind of did that is, you know, you have different lead singers producing some of the stuff, but it is incredible that the same artists behind a song like Magic or Shake It Up are the same ones behind Drive and all sorts of other ones. So I would recommend that you go listen to the Cars because they made some real good music.
My recommendation of the week is to get prepared for this PLL Championship weekend by reading as much stuff as possible. And if you're listening to this, you're probably like consuming Chris and I's content a little passively, because listening to something is a passive activity and reading something is an active activity. Chris and I are going to write previews for this week, but also like check around the internet, kind of see what you can find from different sources from the PLL itself, and kind of soak it all up and rev yourself up to the highest RPM for this first championship game. It really is historic. Chris and I are big supporters of pro lacrosse. We have covered both leagues because we believe in the concept of pro lacrosse, not because we believe in one league over the other. I think it's important for the sport that this championship game and the championship game afterwards in a couple weeks in the MLL is well attended and has a ton of engagement on social media. And also, like, from you, if you're a fan, if you're listening to this, like, you care about pro lacrosse, hopefully, or you're doing some weird research project, in which case, like, what are you doing? But I think the best way to get pumped up is to actively participate, you know, try and get someone who's never seen pro lacrosse to watch the game with you if you can't go. Or if you're in Philly, like, find a friend who's never seen pro lacrosse or lacrosse at all and bring them, because I think it's going to be a watershed moment for everybody involved, and I'm super pumped for it. I will be there. Come up, say hi. I'll be on the sidelines. I'll be in the press box. I'll be all around Philly. Philly's like my second home. I'm really excited that it's there. When they said PLO championships in Philly, I was like, ooh, the only way this could be better is if it's in like Fenway. It's the only place that would have been better for me. I love Philly. Philly's a lot of fun. A lot of spots. Hey, if you're looking for a spot, hit me up. I know a lot of great places in Philly to hang out. And allegedly, Matt Kinnear says the best burger he's ever had in his life is at a special location that he will not share with people in Philly. So hit up Matt Kinnear, get his burger place, and then tell me, because he won't tell me. So do that. Support pro lacrosse. Thanks for listening. You can follow me at @TheKyleDevitt on Twitter. Chris, where can people find you?
I'm @ChrisRosie22 on Twitter.
We will see you next week, hopefully with some interviews from the winning team, some players, some coaches. We're going to go all out. We're going to blow this whole thing out of the water. Thanks for listening. We appreciate you.